Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahalastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Welcome to another episode of Rahalastapa. My guest this week is probably best known for playing the hairy bus in Aqua Teen Hunger Force. It's Doug Stanhope. Here he is. Which I don't know what that is. I picked it out. I love the sound of it. It sounds good. What was the hairy bus in Aqua Teen Hunger Force? It sounds like
it's like stoner TV. I don't know. I just did a voiceover, but it's funny because my regular opener in the States, Junior Stopka, on this last tour, just keeps finding my most obscure things like that. So yeah. He introduces me. He's was on season 2 of Spy TV, and he was the hairy bus.
It's good. It's fun. Well, you know, you get some interest because people never talk about their minor credits, so you often get something interesting out of that. But look, you are time.
I forget them, Richard, and occasionally yes. I'll go on IMDb to see what I've done with my life, and I go, "Oh shit, I forgot about that."
Yeah, well, a lot of people do, and certainly as we're almost exactly the same age, Doug, and I forget what happened 2 days ago now. I write a blog every day. If I don't write it the day after, I can't remember what the fuck I did 2 days ago. So that's
I love it when people that don't drink that are my age forget, because I'm like, all right, because I'd blame the booze otherwise, but nah, it's just part of aging.
Well, I did drink a lot. I've only just stopped. I've stopped drinking for the last couple of years, so it hasn't improved my memory, I have to say, stopping drinking. But I think maybe I did the damage in my 30s and 40s and 20s. Look, so it's a great time for you to come over to the UK on tour. You're currently in Dublin, I understand, which where the reaction to the death of Queen Elizabeth might be slightly different than here in the United Kingdom. So don't lose that.
I've only been getting filled in just now by Brian Hennigan, my manager.
Yeah. So I don't think the Irish...
was trending on Twitter. What were they saying?
Here we go.
Here we go. I don't get it at all. But okay. God's trying to cock block this whole tour. All these dates were booked in 2020 and they just kept getting pushed and pushed. And then Hannigan's trying to book travel last week. He's like, oh shit, there's going to be a rail strike. We're going to have to do a lot of this by car.
Well, the good news is
the Queen dies.
Yeah. Well, the good news is the Queen dying means the rail strike isn't happening. In honor of her, the rail workers are going to work. So that, you know, there's good news and bad news there for you. But are you going to address the loss of? You know, it's a. And I was worried as you were flying over. I was thinking, oh, you know, it's this moment. We're recording this on the Friday, the day after the Queen died. And it's not entirely clear whether venues are going to stay open or close. So yeah. Are you worried about losing some of these amazing dates you have coming up in the UK?
I don't know if I'm more worried about losing the dates or just being stuck in throngs of hundreds of thousands of people while I'm trying to get to a hotel. I have no idea what's going to happen. I'm here. I showed up. I would have showed up during COVID if they didn't cancel the venues. I would have been here. I don't cancel gigs. They canceled gigs. So I'm here and I roll with the punches.
Good.
No, I don't. If you were going to ask, I have no material about the Queen. I really don't know how any of it works. If you're coming out, oh, Doug Stanhope's going to, he'll have great material on this. No, I won't. If I had, I wouldn't hold back if I had a great joke. I just don't.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you tend to avoid those big, you know. I know you're not interested in doing jokes about Trump, which is because it's too obvious. Well, it's too big a subject. There's a great bit in one of your specials about how it's kind of ruined the news for you, because for 5 years all the news has been Trump rather than all the funny stuff that you could pick up on usually.
Yeah. And I'm going further in that direction of right. Not talking. Well, because, you know, social media is ruined because everyone has an opinion now. Every comic that used to be talking about, you know, oh, I have babies and they're like little drunk people or whatever. And now they're all, you know, sign this petition and vote on fucking SR 447 or like, where's it? You used to post GIFs of like a baby falling into a cake or something. There's no funny left. So yeah, I'm going the opposite direction of all that.
Sure. Well, I mean, what I love about your comedy, Doug, and I've been, is it's you're very authentic and very committed to comedy. I was listening to your audiobook this week, Encore for the Donkey, and it sort of shows how dedicated you are to living the life. It's like for some comedians, myself included, probably I kind of wait for things to happen and hope I can make comedy out of those. But I think you sort of get in there and through your somewhat self-destructive lifestyle, things kind of happen to you quite a lot. It's almost like you're living the character, or the character is so much intrinsically part of you and the act. It's hard to divide them.
But yeah, that book was about one. It was a perfectly bookended year of everything going fucked up. So
yeah,
it was 2016, and since then, yeah, things have tempered quite a bit. Yeah.
Okay.
After the wife's coma, it was the most beautiful excuse when she came home. She can't be overstimulated. She can't be around a lot of people. So it was a beautiful excuse to go, hey, we can't have these giant parties anymore. And football, we'll just get down to a handful of friends that actually watch football. It was the best excuse until COVID. And that was a way better excuse to not have fucking people around all the time.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot, that book. It is, you know, it's hard to know. I mean, I think I do admire you, but it's hard not to slight the emotions it raises are also a little bit of, I mean, this is part of your act as well. There's sort of a bit of pity. There's a bit of fear for you. You know, you're very nihilistic. You're sort of unafraid of death or flirt with the idea of death. And, you know, so as a fan or as a reader of your, you know, of your stuff, it's a head. It's good. I mean, it's what art should be. It's a heady mixture of you're this, you know, you're coming out with these amazing routines and brilliant ideas, but also, especially with that year 2016, where everything was fucking up, and a lot of it I've self-inflicted, I have to say.
Yeah,
that you kind of are worried that, I mean, you know, we're both 55, and that kind of lifestyle obviously was a few years ago. So you're in approaching 50, maybe, is hard to sustain.
Yeah, and it gets boring. It starts to hurt. It takes a lot more time to recover, and you forget too much. Like, the more you live like that, you have to. You know, you don't, if it becomes fun, you don't remember it. So you're not even getting good stories out of it.
No. But, you know, a lot of your, the stuff in your act, I watched The Dying of a Last Breed this morning, which is, again, you know, using your real life experiences. It's good for creating comedy, and I suppose it's your honesty. What I like about the book is, I think, as much as people who won't necessarily actually watch your stuff or who are not going to like your stuff might think you're, you know, shocking or offensive or whatever, I think the sort of the decency beneath it all, you're a very decent man. And what I like about the audio book, the book, is, there's a few points where you are looking out for the, you know, for the ostracized people in society or the lonely people in society. I mean, it starts with you having a party on a boat and not letting any beautiful people get into the jacuzzi with you. Only the ugly people who wouldn't usually be allowed to do that. So, and you know, that shows a sort of, there's a heart behind your work that I think people, you know, might not want to see if they've decided what kind of comic you are, but you're a decent guy.
Yeah, I was always curious where people go, wow, it's so weird to meet you in person, because I thought you'd be like a real asshole. I never really see that coming through in my act. I mean, I yell a lot and I'll say something that might, you know, rub people the wrong way, but I always have an arguable point. If it is something controversial, there's some logic base to it, and then a fist fuck joke at the end, so I can call it comedy.
Absolutely, for sure. Do you think that the problem? You know, I think with certainly like with there's a lot of sort of macho US comics, I think, and that maybe use offense just as a merely as a punchline. And they're not as sophisticated or thoughtful, I think, as comedians as you are sometimes. And I wonder if that's the reason that people start to think comedy shouldn't. I mean, you and I obviously believe comedy should be able to tackle any subject. There's a way of finding comedy in everything, and it doesn't. And it's not about if you do jokes about stuff that isn't that you're not taking it seriously or you don't care about it. But there's less good comedians than you, I think, can. Do offensive stuff just for the sake of being offensive, which it never feels like your act is that.
I have two cousins, one who's a religious zealot, right wing Republican, and then her younger sister, who is still kind of conservative, but a late outcoming lesbian, works with deaf kids, and I thought if either one of them came to my show and brought their friends, both of their friends, both the liberal and right wing, would find reason to be offended and leave. You're kind of a man without a country if you're pragmatic. And because people will hear one thing and go, oh, he's like this or he's like this. They would both find reason to say I was the other, where you can not have a side. It's okay to not have a side and just take every issue as it comes. But have you noticed that over here? Because I haven't been over here in a while, but since everything's like splitting into party lines, I don't even know if that's the biggest thing over here. I could name a fucking dozen American comics who used to just be comics, and now they've because there's money in taking sides. So now their podcast is hardcore right wing or hardcore left wing, because if you get into a fight and pick a side, you're going to sell way more tickets. And, you know,
yeah, no, I think that's definitely happening to an extent here as well. Yeah, and I think with audiences as well, that they only see the joke that's aimed at their side. So if you're and I think in the old day, I think you're right. I think if comedians, not, you know, there's no generalizations you can make about comedians, and not all, or at least they all fall apart. But a comedian should be able to take the piss out of everything, and should be looking to take the piss out of everything and themselves, what they think themselves, and you know. And
I know a lot that are just calculated. Okay, I'm going to go full this way or full that way. And just, you know, it's, what are you, a fucking wrestler? You don't believe that. You just know it's going to make you money, and it's going to get your podcast noticed, and it's phony.
No, it's definitely phony. I mean, I was going to mention Jerry Sadovitz, who I think like is a comedian who is not, I don't know if you know Jerry, he's sort of equivalent to you to an extent, in that I think he is authentically living his life and his comedy hand in hand, and he sort of is horrible. He's not the same as you on stage, but he's horrible about everything. I mean, to the extent that you watch it and some of it makes you feel sick. But
I've heard about him for years, and he's a bucket list comic. And then when I read about what happened at Edinburgh, I know I sent out a tweet in his. On his behalf, in his, not in his defense, because I wasn't there, but I've since heard that it was only the staff that complained about him. Actually, no one in the audience was offended or walked out, and it was the people that worked there that were bitching about it.
Yeah, I think that was the problem with young staff members who hadn't, you know, he's been going for 30 or 40 years, and, you know, the venue knew that. I think what's shocking about it is, well, A, is he's been sort of, the gig was, you know, stopped from saying we believe in free speech, but there's some things you can't say or whatever. It's like they had a list of things you're not allowed to say, but they hadn't shared the venue hadn't gone, by the way, if you say this word, you'll be taken off. So there's a secret list of some. And I suppose the problem is that you can hear a word and go, well, I think that's the way the world's become very sort of binary, is that people are waiting to hear a word to tick off a list rather than understanding the intent behind it. With Jerry, he's the bottom of the pile and he's fighting out everyone. I mean, and he lives the life, and whereas you might have had a party life, I feel Jerry's had a very unhappy life of being this guy sort of punching upwards at everyone. And so it would be weird in a way if he chose, you know, if he said, well, I'm going to go with everyone, but I'm going to not do any of the race stuff anymore, because that in itself, within his act, it would be almost sort of a racist thing to do. But also you should be able to, you know, in art, you should be able to, I think people don't see comedy as art, and people don't see comedy as anything more than jokes. So when you're doing something a bit more complex, it's not just about, did you say the word or didn't, you know, did you say this word and then for you stop. So, there's a similarity. I mean, there's in the special I saw, you did a sort of complex routine about Indian call centers, which again is a subject that right-wing lazy comedians will go in a different way than you went, which is to go, why is everyone Indian? Which yours is much more complex, but gets in.
Well,
gets,
yeah, no, it goes into it's that that was the segue into Indian gang rape.
Yeah, so it's a complex routine. But it's the idea that you can't joke about anything. But that one is, you know, it's playing around with those perceptions, which, you know, again, I think intelligent comedy can do, and which I think you know, I mean, when you've been going as long as you have, you kind of hope that people would trust that you know what you're doing. But I suppose ultimately it's about people making their own choice about what they're going to see. You're a comedian who, I suppose, if venues decided to cancel you, then you could be cancelled, but you can't really be cancelled because you've got nothing to be cancelled from apart from your podcast and your live tours.
I don't have no sponsors. When, you know, when comics in the States are getting canceled, that means, oh, you got kicked off a TV show. But your stand-ups, Louis C.K. could have gone out the day after and sold out a room 10 times as big as I could sell out at the worst of his reputation. He could still do stand up. And when he did, yeah, people showed up.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think, you know, I don't think canceling, I mean, it's weird when a gig gets stopped, but with Jerry, it's just meant he could go and play a much bigger venue than he would have ever got to play. So it's sort of, if you, and I'm sure Jerry wasn't being cynical about it. He's not that kind of guy, but, you know, you could cynically do this and go, okay, I can boost my career by going down this road. But, yeah.
What? Oh, Chris Rock, you know, with the slap.
Yeah.
Yeah, his tickets went through the roof. Any kind of controversy, and I do talk about this in my act, it's a cancel culture on some levels is good for business in our business.
I think you have to do something pretty extreme. You know, and I can't, I think, well, you know, in the book, you're friends with Roseanne, who's the person I think most of all has been most affected by being cancelled, and that she was kicked off her own TV show, which is is pretty extreme. But I mean, I can't think of many people who.
But she can still go out and do stand up.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
People love her, and she is very funny. And when you look at her life, like all the things she's done for, you know, downtrodden people and victims of sexual abuse and everyone, she's just out of her fucking mind. I talk about her in the act too.
So tell us about the tour, Eddie. Well, let's talk about the tour. You're coming to a lot of cities in the UK. Having just turned off my phone and lost what they are. Is this all new material, or is it a mixture of?
It's nothing I've done over here. So, yeah, tomorrow I get a long day of trying to figure out, okay, what of the new stuff that I've been doing in the States, plus the stuff that I can't do over there anymore but want to do over here because I haven't done it, and how to segue it all together. Like, I have plenty of material. It's just now it's like a crossword puzzle of, okay, what goes with this? Because I've been doing it like this, but now I have to change it up, and then I have to go through, okay, when you think a bit's going to work, oh, this whole chunk of material will be fine over here. And then you go, wait, like three of the big laughs are references they're probably not going to get. So,
yeah.
And I took this summer off, and then I just did 3 weeks relearning what I was doing before I took the summer off. Did that in the States the whole time on stage thinking, okay, that reference is not going to work over there. They have Mad Libs. Do they know what Scooby-Doo is? And I'm completely in my head relearning what I have to do here that I'm going to learn how to do. It'll be perfect by the time I leave in 3 weeks. And then I'm going to have to go back to the States and unlearn it and relearn the other way.
Yeah. You've been here over here a lot, though. So you've got a better handle. Some US comics come across and just, you know, 20% of their act is like references to stuff that we're not going to get. Whereas most of those things you mentioned, I think we would understand. So you are aware of stuff. I guess over here you might be best known for the appearances on Charlie Brooker's Screen White show, though that was a little while ago. But I was watching a couple of those this morning as well to remind myself of those. And those were lots of that was all that when it was because it was looking at America, wasn't it? An American culture as a correspondent.
Voice of America. I just found out not long ago from Hennigan, my manager, Black Charlie Brooker's show,
Black Mirror, yeah.
Black Mirror. Yeah. They wanted me to play the judge in the first episode, which is by far the best episode ever of the pig fucking.
Right.
They wanted me to play the judge, and Hennigan, I would have had to stay longer on the tour, and I was so fucking tired of the tour that I just said no without even asking about it. And then later on he goes, yeah, that's the thing you said no to. I'm like, damn it.
As well, these missed opportunities that you don't do much. You occasionally crop up, and I know you don't really like sitcoms, but you did the Roseanne sitcom, didn't you? I think, and you occasionally crop up with little bits of acting. But is it something you're not? I mean, it feels like you're that stand up is your home and podcasts, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I'm not. I don't like acting much. I did star in a movie that I starred in a movie, so that's why I did it. And I don't think you'll be seeing it in theaters, but
it sounds about the same as. That's about the same as my acting. I end up acting in lots of independent and weird little films. But yes, that's all good fun. I mean,
it was playing a 55-year-old alcoholic stand-up comedian who's okay. chain smokes and is dying of liver failure, doing shitty gigs on the road in the States. And I'm like, okay. All right, that's easy. And I have the month off anyway, so I'll go do it just for the experience, and hopefully I'll get some material out of it. It's low budget. Maybe it'll be the story value, and it was a fine time, which sucked because I'm like, there's nothing funny in a fine time.
No, that's true.
So there's, I get no jokes out of it, and no. I don't know if it's gonna suck. Like when you do stand up, you know in the moment if it sucks or not. You do a movie and it's all you. It's gonna be a year and a half before you know if you suck.
Well, it depends how it all gets put together, but at least, I mean, I think the thing with stand-up in movies is you don't often see it done very well. It's very rare. So at least to have someone who is authentically can understand what that part is, that gives it some hope of being realistic and authentic.
Yeah, I rewrote half the movie as we were going.
Well, that's good. The last film I did was entirely improvised, which is absolutely the way to go. A, if your memory's not good, because I can never remember lines anymore, but also just then you can really put your creative input into stuff, and it's really good fun to do it that way. But
I'm shit at improvising. I still if I say something spontaneous on stage that's funny, I clap like it's my first time on stage. I'm patting myself on the back inside. It was a lot of rewrites, but improvising, especially with a camera on me.
Yeah, well, this was weird because it was because it was all improvised. It was sort of awkward to begin with, and then you get into it and. Also, it doesn't matter, you know, you're filming so much, it doesn't matter. And you reshoot, if something works, just reshoot and have another go at it. It was a really interesting way to work. I'd like to do more of it because it was creatively, it was very interesting. And then you don't have time to, my problem with acting is, you know, as a comedian, is you kind of, I think you're sort of step outside and you're too aware to be a good actor. But if you're just in it, you haven't got time to think about acting. So you just get on with it. It was interesting.
Yeah, it's when you're supposed to shut up. That's when I have a problem with acting. Like, okay, you talk, then what do? Go grab a beer? I don't know what to do with myself while you're doing your line.
Well, it sounds in that film like that might not have been a problem, that you would probably be allowed to carry on talking if that's the character you are playing. Because comedians can talk, they can talk.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Let me ask you an emergency question. These are just some stupid questions I ask people every now and again. If you were going to be in a human centipede, Doug, I mean, you're in the middle, but they let you choose the people at either end. Who would you like in front of you and behind you in your human centipede?
Oh, wow.
Talking of improvisation,
you should submit these questions ahead of time so I have time to think.
I don't want you to think about it. I want a gut reaction, literally in this case.
I guess I'd want a bulimic in the front.
Okay, that could work. Is there anyone you'd like to shit into the mouth of that you haven't already? Because having seen some of your work and listened to your book, there's a very good chance you've shat in people already.
I don't know. Who have I hated today, Brian? There's too many. I find myself just watching the news and just every person, I hate you. I fucking hate your face. And then the commercials come on and I fucking hate you. And then when you just hate that much in a row, you go, that's me. This is a problem with me. These people are not that.
Well, I'll give you one from my own watching of TV over the last couple of days. I would like you to shit in the mouth of Nicholas Witchell. And that name won't mean anything to you. And you're a lucky man for not knowing it. But he's the royal correspondent at the BBC, who's a very obsequious, fawning guy who kind of waits for these moments, and then when they come up, he's center stage. And there was someone had a quote about the Corgis. I don't think he said this yesterday, but he may have done, saying that they don't know the Queen status and they still love her. It was something along those lines. But I think those Corgis still get to look at other dogs and go, "There's something going on here."
I want to burn a bridge ahead of time, but I think that bridge is going to burn. You know where I'm going, Hennigan? I'm supposed to do an interview with someone who's would be the back part of my human centipede.
All right.
But the interview's scheduled for the day after the funeral. So okay. There's no way they're going to fucking put Doug Stanhope, completely unknown comedian, on the day after the Queen's funeral.
But you might slip through.
Yeah, he would be. If that interview happens, I plan to figuratively shit in his mouth in the interview.
We'll look forward to it. That'd be good. So I'm kind of intrigued about I know you didn't like Hollywood very much, but what prompted you to move to Bisbee, which sounds like an amazing place from all your stories and from your books? But what made you decide to go to live in Bisbee?
Well, I did my 10-year stint in L.A., and I just couldn't live there anymore. There was no reason to. I just wanted to travel and, you know, go back to just doing comedy. I didn't want to audition for commercials anymore just because my agent told me I should. I would do so much shit in L.A. just because my agent said, "Oh, he said it." I didn't realize for a while you can say no.
Right.
Oh, I could say no to my agent? I thought I had to do everything you said. And so Bisbee was a town that I'd found driving in and out of L.A. to go out on the road. And it was I always love small towns. I live my life to avoid traffic, which is one of the main reasons I fucking hate the UK. I hate London. Just, it's claustrophobic. And the older I get, the more space I need. I feel like a 600-pound man when I'm walking down a street or getting in an elevator in the UK. So yeah, it's a small town, but it wasn't like rednecky, stupid small town. And I loved it. And that's one of the things that quarantine spoiled me, is where I go, this is now I know this is what I want to do.
Right.
There's absolutely nothing. A small town. When you've been on the road for a while, I've lived there for 17 years now. At that point, 15 years. And it was the first time I'd stayed in my own bed, in the same bed in my life since I was a teenager. Like for a full year, was turned into 18 months, but I'd never spent that. I knew where all my shit was. Like for the first time, the 15 years I had that house, I'd never like, I organized, you know, my Tupperware drawer. I had my closet organized and like everything. I didn't know where my shit was. You get home and you dump your shit and you sprawl out on the couch for a few days and catch up on whatever shows are on your DVR and feed the whatever pets are still alive and then go back out on the road. You don't really know where your shit is. And after a year and a half, I'm like, I love being a homeowner.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm the same, but I think in the UK touring is so different. I can't really get my head around what your life must be like doing a United States tour, and because you play around the world so much that you really are just going from hotel to hotel so much of the time. Whereas I can get home from 50-60% of the gigs I do in the UK, I can still get home from.
Yeah, my tour manager drove the van from Bisbee, where we live, to our first gig in Michigan, and that took 5 days. I mean, they took their time just for him to meet me where I flew to meet him. And then we drove, you know, a couple thousand miles. And then, yeah, I flew home just to unpack, repack for this. And then I'll fly back and then we'll do another, you know, 5,000 miles through the Southeast back home when I get back.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of travel.
Do you think you can keep it up? Because that's what I haven't really toured. I did a tour of the podcast, but I haven't toured stand-up for a few years. And that's the thing that I really want to get back into stand-up. But the thing that puts me off is all the traveling. Do you think it's something you're going to be able to carry on doing for the next 5, 10, 15 years? Or is it going to come to a point where you go, right, I'm just staying at home? Because you're doing all your podcasts. You don't have to. You could just work from home.
Yeah, if I could set up a club at my house, which we do have kind of a club where we tape our podcast, the Funhouse. It's a standalone building on my property. It's 18 by 20, but we have a little tiny corner stage in it, and we filmed a couple specials in there. Yeah. I can put 30 people in there, jam tight, but you know, 30 people slammed into a room is a great audience. And I thought, what if I just had people come to me like Vegas and make an exclusive thing, vet them, like put what the audience puts on comedians as far as trying to be the police. No, we're going to vet you to see if you're a good audience member. We're going to check your references. Go beyond the Dave Chappelle putting your cell phone in a bag. No, we're going to call references.
That's a good idea. Oh, no, you can do it. I'm sure you can do it. I mean, I like the bit in the special again where you addressed racists in your audience and told them that they were idiots if they were enjoying the material on the wrong level and didn't understand it. So that's the first step. You just tell them you're not welcome, and then you've got to pass a test to get in.
People would say, well, you know, you mean it in a certain way, but other people might be laughing for the wrong reasons. Then yell at them for being fucking idiots. Don't blame me. I know what I'm talking about. Blame the people who are laughing wrong.
It's true. It is very much true. And you talk about dying and you talk about, I mean, in the book, again, you talk about the number of comedian friends you've had who die. And it seems to be something you're not worried about. You're not actively looking after your own health. I think, would it be fair to say, or are you getting better in that regard?
No, when I'm at home, I'm really I eat healthy-ish. I mean, compared to the road,
yeah,
where you're just shoveling whatever fucking drive-through shit you can get in your head before showtime. Yeah, I eat healthy. I still smoke way too much, and I still drink, but I haven't done drugs. I've been doing edibles, which I think is really good. I was never a weed guy, but now they're legal and they're everywhere. It's just everyone has way too much weed because it became legal and people hoard it and now they're giving it away. So yeah, I dabble in edibles and like I have fun writing when I'm high, like actually writing being enjoyable as a process. I mean, a lot of the material that comes out of it is unusable, but I laugh my ass off at myself. Like I was writing out a set when I first came back from after COVID, after 18 months, and I got high by myself and I started on a yellow legal pad, just writing out a set. And after a while I'm writing in hecklers and then writing my response to hecklers that don't exist. And I'm laughing like this all by myself. I'm crying. And a few of the ideas actually worked, but just having the overall process of spending like 4 or 5 hours writing every detail of a set that doesn't exist.
But so, it's good because I think like I wouldn't do that, but I think the problem I have with writing is overcoming that, you know, actually that first splurge and everything. You just want to get as much stuff down and open up your brain and not worry if it's shit or if it's good and just see what comes out. So if you can actually create that mindset through artificial means, then I guess that's a good way of doing this, because you would. You know, if you're writing sober, you would write an equal amount of stuff that didn't work, I'm sure, and maybe less stuff that would work. Who knows?
Yeah. Right now, it's just a matter of, like, I have so many things that I've been doing in different ways. And now, again, it's just piecing together. Okay, how does that go into that? And fuck segues. And then I always have a notes in one pocket of just the shit that I did write high, that has no home or will never go anywhere or is just silly, or that I'll just break that out. Okay, I'm at the end of this train of thought. Let's go to the high notes and just pick randomly things that are stupid or just not worked out, and then move on from there.
And do you find, I mean, obviously you've found a way to self-medicate with alcohol that works, but because I had to stop drinking on stage when I was drinking because I just found it dulled my perceptions too much, or my reaction time wasn't good enough, or it just got too, occasionally I'd do a drug, you know, you do a club where the idea was to get drunk and it was sort of interesting, but it's actually quite hard to control the situation. Have you just got good at doing that with a drink in your hand, or are you kind of
drinking helps me in the opposite way. I just did for the first time, I did a full set in Detroit where I on an edible, and I got a little goofy, but it also. It reanimated all the things. The reasons I drink on stage are because otherwise I would be too focused on, oh, that lady's looking at her watch, and those people, they're on their phone. They're walking out. Are they walking out of my show, or are they just going to the restroom? All that stuff. I drink and I don't think about that, and then I can get into my set and. You know, act, perform. I'm not. Yeah. And then when I was high, what I did notice was, oh, I'm drinking and I'm high. And now I'm like, oh, that person just keeps talking to the person next to them. Am I running late? Like just, it brought all that shit back, all that kind of paranoia, inner workings. So yeah, so far it's good for writing and it's good for fun. And it puts me in a way happier mindset off stage, but I'm not ready to go full bore edibles on stage. I'm going to stick with the cocktails.
Okay. And do you think you know, I've seen it said that you're only happy when you're sad. Do you think that's true about you, or is that just the character, or is that the real Doug Stanhope that's only happy when they're sad?
I love to complain, because that's really where most comedy comes from. On this last tour, a friend of mine was spreading her father's ashes on all the highest points in all 50 states, and saw that one of them was on. Between your gigs, my dad loved you, and he would mean so much if you would go on. It's just a 1 mile hike to spread his ashes, and it's the last state. And I said yes, and I had the fucking my tour manager and his wife and my opener all agreed to go. And this 1 mile hike, I go, what does hiking include fucking using your hands and knees? We're like climbing fucking mountains. Shit. Yeah, it's a mile, but it's a mile. And I was bitching the entire time. But I go, oh, well, this is fantastic, because I'm going to bitch about this on stage and have something new to complain about. And when you have something new to say right off the top of your act, it refreshes all the shit that you've been saying that you get tired of. So, yeah. I love to bitch.
Well, you've got to see, you say you don't like improvisation, but like in your life, it seems to me, you're very yes and, which is the heart of improvisation, that if someone says, do this, or can I do, you know, that you'll have a go, you know, in real life, I'm very reticent, and I think I'd miss out on lots of adventures, and adventures still happen to me, but it's very much against my will, which maybe is funny in a different way. But it feels with you that you'll take up challenges, and you'll do stupid bets, and you'll, if someone says, come and climb a mountain, you'll climb the mountain with them.
No, I agree. And that's one of the things I said that night. I only agreed to it because I didn't like her enough to say no. She's not that good of a friend. Like my good friends, people I'm comfortable with, I would have no problem going, yeah, fuck yourself. I'm not hiking up for a mile, even if it is on flat ground. But yeah, you know, when you have to be polite to someone, no, I'm like you. I say no to almost everything. And that, right. Then after I get a good five or six minutes off the top of my set, I go, I have to do things I hate more often, because it's business.
But you know, you'll get stuff by trying to create instance in that way. You'll get stuff that no other comedian will get. That's what I suppose is interesting, and that's it. Always feels with your stuff, it's not. You know, I don't think I've ever seen anything you've done and gone, oh yeah, I've seen this done before, or I've seen it done this way before. You really managed to come, which is very hard, I think, as a comedian, to never kind of hit a hack idea or a hack subject. Or if you do hit a subject that might be hack, you're coming at it from a completely different angle, so it isn't.
You know, that last special you were talking about, there's a whole chunk about, you know, 2.5-star hotels versus 1-star. And I know it was self-indulgent, and probably it was not unique premises, but at some point you have to, like, this is shit that really bothers me that I need to say. And yeah, it wasn't really, I don't know.
Different. That even that was different. That's not the same. You're coming at it from the character's so strong, the character of Doug Stanhope, which, you know, how much of it's you and how much of it's the artifice for stage is, you know, is obviously up for question. But the character's so strong, and that even if you're looking at hotels, you're doing it in a way that, because you're talking about wanting to stay at 1-star hotels because the reviews are bad, because they give you clues about things that you'll want to do. It's a very Doug Stanhope routine that I don't think if I did that, people go, well, you don't want to go to Hookers and go to a bar at 4 o'clock. So you know, it's unstealable, I think, is probably the, if you've got an act, and comedians' act should be unstealable. You know, your act should be good enough that only you can really do it, I think, unless you're literally just a gag comedian, which is fine. I mean, and anyone could do gags. But if you're doing anything with a bit more depth
That's why I'm unstealable, is my bits are 20 minutes long and I'm doing them in a, a society where, you know, 30-second clips are as much as people can tolerate. No.
Well, that's, but that's, I think that's a very, you know, that's, you feel like a very British comedian to me, as American as you are, because of that, I suppose, in that it is, you know, it feels like your shows are Edinburgh shows rather than even specials, you know, which often comedian specials are still just a collection of routines and jokes, but there's more to it than that. But maybe that's because you've been over here a little bit, or maybe that's just, maybe the sensibility just chimes more than some American comedians for me. But I do know your stuff are better than a lot of the American stand-ups. But you do have this kind of very interesting life, because you're living in Bisbee, but you were also hanging out at Johnny Depp's house. And, you know, it's this weird dichotomy of a life that you have.
It's not a regular thing.
No, but even for that to happen once, but you say it happens a few times to you, you know Johnny Depp, you're friends with Johnny Depp. So it's an interesting, you know, you have experiences that other people wouldn't have.
I'm pissing while we talk. I don't know if this is a first for your podcast, but...
It is. I was going to say, I was wondering if that's where you're going, but that's okay. Yeah. No, it's nice. That's all right.
I'm hitting the water just for the... but I'll hit the porcelain now. I just... For authenticity, yeah. I wanted to hit the water.
Yeah, it is the first, because I do too many over Zoom. I did all through lockdown, but nobody went to the toilet. If anyone did go to the toilet, they said, can I stop and go to the toilet? So it is a first. Thank you, Doug, for that at least. And there you go. We've got something that could no other comedian could do. It's on film, but luckily we only got the top half, so that's all right. Though I know that as a man who's exposed himself to Louis C.K., that's in a way you were getting the revenge in first there, and I think that was good for you. But you've been doing comedy since we'll wrap up soon. Well, you've been at the Loo now.
Oh, no, I'm not in a hurry.
Okay, good.
Not anymore.
I'm always interested in the stuff that people did before they were comedians, or when they were struggling to be comedians. And I noticed that you used to, I mean, you worked in telemarketing, right? But you also did gay sex lines. Is that true?
I did that one as a goof.
Right.
But before that, I did fraud telemarketing, borderline gray area fraud. Telemarketing. What's fun now? The guy that fired me from my last fraud telemarketing job in Vegas in 1989, I guess, is now the governor of Nevada. Steve Sisolak.
Okay. And what does it? How is something almost a fraud without being a fraud? What sort of things were you selling to people?
It was basically like you get phishing spam now. You won a big prize.
Right.
You're selling them like advertising specialties, like this, a pen with their company name on it. But because they were in, you know, you're guaranteed to win one of these big prizes. And one of them's like, it's a trip for two to Hawaii. But what it is, it's a certificate that one person goes free and the other pays double, basically.
Okay.
So it's all in the wording of how you say it.
So he
ran one of the rooms, and now he's the governor of Nevada. I wrote about it. I wrote the whole thing in my first book, Digging Up Mother. And the specifics of the scam and him firing me, and now he's governor, and I'll occasionally tweet at him, "Hey Steve, you think you want to take me back to work your phone banks for your reelection campaign?" Hello. Yeah, he's ignored me.
What a shame. He should get in touch with you. What drew you to comedy in the first place? Because you've basically been doing comedy since you were like 23, right? So
yeah.
What pushed, and you started in Las Vegas, what pushed you towards stand-up?
I was always I wasn't like class clown, but I was like the funny, almost school shooter. Like I was the class clown, but my sense of humor was for a limited audience, just like it is now. I was always too dark for the room for class clown. I kind of horrified people, but I was always drawn to comedy. I always loved watching comedy. And when I was in Vegas and there was open mics everywhere, I used to go to one near my house and every Tuesday night and go, "Hey, if I write some material, can I go up next week?" And then, yeah, sure. And, it became a running joke, but after about the sixth time, I actually had 4 minutes and went up and did it and did six open mics in my second week of comedy. That's how much comedy there was back then in 1990.
Yeah, I think it was similar in the UK, really. You know, we would I would sort of start. I started in about 1990, and there was you would go to a club, and then sometimes you could headline it the next week. It was there was so much stuff going on,
but there were very few comics. I think that looking back, I would say there was probably a dozen open mic comics that would just do all the open mic nights, and now. You know, there's an open mic in Tucson, the closest city to me, that has an open mic once a week. And like 40, 50 people will sign up.
Yeah, it's definitely the same here. There's a lot of people who want to be comedians. I guess it was the same in America as it was in the UK, that you weren't really thinking this is going to lead to being a profitable career necessarily.
The same way you'd get drunk and dare someone to do karaoke.
Yeah.
All right. I could probably sing Joe Jackson. I can get away with some Joe Jackson. You're not going, "Oh, I'm going to be on America's Got Talent."
It's true. And another thing I liked about the book was, and again, I think this sort of possibly explains your style of comedy to people who don't think you should joke about these subjects, is you discuss the palliative nature of comedy. And it really, in the book, in this third or fourth of your books, the Encore for the Donkey, so many terrible things are happening and you're joking about them as they go along. But in order, there's, for some people, the worst thing in your life happens to you, and the best way to get through it is through laughter, right? I think that's, and that helps you cope with the situation.
Yeah, but I don't think you go, "Oh, hey, hang on, we need comedy right now." I think it's just your natural default mode is to, and that's also when I laugh the most, is when something's really fucked up.
Yeah.
I've laughed like this where my girlfriend's crying, and but you're so adorable when you're crying, and it just makes me laugh the more she starts crying about something dark. It's not a calculated, "Okay, we're going to need comedy."
But then also within the book, you're sort of cracking jokes as your partner is being taken to hospital, and it turns out to be an extremely life-threateningly dangerous situation that you don't see because you're off your nut a bit as well, that you don't really appreciate how serious it is,
But if I did understand that it was that serious, which eventually we did, and then we kept like a skunk never says, "You know what? Maybe this is a wrong time for spraying." That's what they do.
So, look, let me take everyone through where your tour dates are, and that everyone should buy tickets on the 14th of September. You are also going to Australia next year, I should mention, but we'll just go through the UK coming up. 14th of September, you're in Newcastle. 15th, you're in Sheffield, O2 Academy. It's a big venue. 16th at the Manchester Apollo. O2 Apollo, 17th in Southampton. That's an odd choice out of all the places you could go to. You got a lot of fans in Southampton.
I have no idea what Hannigan tells me where we're going. I don't know.
Southampton, you're going all the big cities and Southampton, but it'll be all right. London on, I know one of these London dates is sold out, 19th here in London. I think there's an extra London date, isn't there? But I think that's sold out. And you're in Cardiff, St David's Hall, fantastic venue, 21st of September. Birmingham, 22nd. Glasgow, O2 Academy, 23rd. And Leeds on the 24th. It's a pretty full-on UK tour, and those are big, big venues.
I like Hennigan's very honest with me. He goes, "Well, Newcastle, we haven't sold a lot of tickets, but the good news is we're in a smaller venue than last time."
There's a lot of comedy fans in Newcastle. They'll come out for you. They're good guys in Newcastle. There's a lot of good comedy in Newcastle. Maybe not on a Wednesday night. I don't know.
We did this horrendous tour in 2012, just ill-fated 7 weeks of the UK.
Right.
At one point, they had rented us a double-decker tour bus that was last used for Lady Gaga's dancers. It was a 14 sleeping berth double decker tour bus. And like, yeah, it's me and the opening act. Somehow we had like five different managers or helpers. I'm like, what is going on? This is like how MC Hammer lost all his money. I don't know why, but I remember we played Newcastle was great. And, until we played Wolverhampton, Newcastle was my favorite football team. Now it's Wolves, even though we never go back to Wolverhampton. Point being, like 6 days later, we're playing Sunderland, and we played like a 2,000 seater with like 115 people in it. And I go, "Well, you just played Newcastle's right across the street," and I'm like, "Yeah, who's putting this tour together?" So yeah.
Anyway, but also that's the way that it's absolutely UK touring is so weird. That's fairly typical that you can sell out somewhere and then go. I mean, yeah, if it's nearby, there's a possible reason. Though Sunderland and Newcastle people will not go into each other's cities. So there's no reason Sunderland shouldn't. They will not. They hate each other and they wouldn't be seen dead in each other's cities. So I don't know what happened there. Don't know what happened in Sunderland. They don't deserve you.
Yeah, well, it's I'm not going back, as you can see.
And do you enjoy that? I mean, I've had a lot of gigs like that, and certainly, like when in the days we were in a double act that was on TV, we'd get booked into big venues, and 100 people would come. Do you enjoy those gigs, or is it too embarrassing? I find it quite embarrassing, but I think you'd overcome the embarrassment.
It's terrible because they weren't even sitting together. All right, two over here and four, eight rows away. And a couple in the back, you're like, all right. It can be funny, but on a 7 week tour of, I didn't know there's 7 weeks worth of cities in this whole block of islands.
I mean, there is, but you've got to start going small. You know, Southampton would be very cosmopolitan compared to the place you have to go on a 7 week tour. I mean, that's what, you know, that's sort of, I guess my tours are usually that 50 or 60 or 70 dates is what you sort of have to do to make it profitable at my level, but there we go. Look, Doug, it's lovely to see you, and I really massively appreciate you. I know you've just got off a plane, and you've stepped into a world where an old lady has died, and everyone's. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens in the next week.
Again, the more fucked up it is, the funnier it is.
I think the country is about to lose its mind. There's been plenty of things that we could have lost our mind over, but I think not having the Queen at there, she's like having a hand on the helm as we've been filling up with water. Now her hand is gone, and I think we're probably fucked.
It's funny you say that, because 2-3 days ago, where my wife and I were watching the news, and they showed, I forget what it was, but the Queen was shaking someone's hand. And I paused the TV. I go, look at her hand. Because her hand was that old, like all black. Like when the old people get that, like it's just a deep purple contusion. But that's what they look like all the time. I'm like, oh, look at the monkey paw. Ew. And then yesterday I go, guess who's dead, honey? Yep. And I'm flying over there right now.
I have a feeling she'd been on a drip, like she was seriously ill. She was meeting the Prime Minister you need to do that for her to become prime minister. And I think they'd literally just taken her off the drip then put her back on it again. It probably killed her. I'm not saying the prime minister killed the queen, but, you know, draw your own conclusions is what I would say. Look, it's been really lovely to talk to you. I won't hold you up anymore, just in case you feel like
I'm glad to have shared this time together.
It's lovely to see you. if the new show's anything like the stuff I've seen already, it's going to be, and I'm sure it is, it's going to be absolutely fantastic. So everyone go and see the wonderful Doug stand-up. Maybe not if you're easily offended, but if you like good jokes, go and see Doug, who's one of the absolute top stand-up comedians in the world. Thank you very much. This is the end of the 24 series. We'll be back on Wednesday with the next one with Rhys Shearsmith, provided my shows don't get cancelled by the death of the Queen. Thanks, Doug.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Rahulastapa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Doug Stanhope. Thank you to Scant Regard, who provide the music for these credits and do nothing else. The lazy people. I'm indebted to my director and friend, Chris Evans, not that one, who set up all of this, and to Doug's people, who did fantastic work in setting this up. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStripe.com production. Head to GoFasterStripe.com and buy some downloads or books. Help little Chris Evans knock that one out, if you can. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends about this podcast. Make them listen too. Every new listener is another few tenths of a pence in the kitty. Thank you. Goodbye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks for listening. Go to GoFasterStripe.com for all your Richard Herring download and book needs. Go to RichHerring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can. And make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.